Hello, I'm Bruce Celery. This is Moolah La, Money Made Simple. If you're a pro athlete or dream of becoming one, there are many different unique financial challenges you might have to deal with. Income fluctuations, sudden relocations, unpredictable contracts, whole bunch of things. Paul Wiley is the head of the Family Office Canada at BMO Private Wealth, and he's here to give us some insight into a world I will never, ever, ever be a part of. Then, fighting fraud, some encouraging stats from Equifax Canada. In a recent survey, it found that Canadians are fighting back against fraud more than ever before. So what steps are people taking to protect their personal information? Julie Kuzmic is Equifax Canada's Senior Compliance Officer, Consumer Advocacy. She's here to talk about that. And making an estate plan, no easy job. One step that often gets overlooked in terms of its importance is choosing an executor. Some people make a choice to go for a corporate executor, but they're few and far between, in large part because a lot of people don't even know how it works. Leanne Kaufman is the president and CEO of RBC Trust, RBC Royal Trust. She joins us to tell us about some of the reasons why people would do that, how it works, and what it costs. Plus, what's your money management style? Personal finance expert and author Melissa Leong. She's here to talk about some different money personalities and what insight you can use from those personalities to understand yourself better. This is Moolah La, Money Made Simple, brought to you in part by Credit Canada, the first and longest standing nonprofit credit counseling agency in the country. Let's get started. I love a personality test. Now, some of these tests are grounded in scientific research that has been, you know, they think about it, they quantify it. So there's some science. And some of these tests are basically ripped from Cosmopolitan magazine from like the 70s, right? They're just like, it's like a bad horoscope, utter fiction, complete and utter fiction. But the good ones can sometimes illuminate our similarities and our differences in a helpful way, including in the area of money. So we're going to take a closer look at one of these money management personality tests, and we're going to use one of our favorite personal finance experts to talk about that. Melissa Leong is an expert. She's on the social. She's everywhere. And she's also the author of a great book called Happy Go Money. Hello there.
Hi, Bruce. I love that you referenced Cosmo magazine.
Oh, yeah. Did it take you back to your teenhood, like your 14-year-old self?
I'm sorry. I love quizzes. I love the ridiculous ones in teen magazines. I love the pop quizzes in school because I was the nerdy girl with headgear. So this is my jam.
Oh, yes. So how do you think about these tests? Do you think they're helpful?
I actually do. I mean, I completely agree with you. Some of them are just fun and random, but others are absolutely created based on psychology, on common money beliefs and behaviors that researchers have actually broken down and recognized. I mean, these money styles reveal your personal money beliefs, how you use money, your habits, your tendencies. So I really, and I think you can relate to more than one personality, but I really think that by just identifying your money personality, looking into it, this is key. This is key to being better with money.
We're going to talk about one that comes from Ramit Sethi. He is the person behind I Will Teach You to Be Rich. He does many, many things, podcasts, books, all that. He's got five archetypes or styles or whatever. The first one is ostriches. This paints a very clear visual image of the behavior of someone who might fit that style. What would you say about this style?
I identified a couple of money personalities in my own book. And so there is a little bit of overlap. There's some that is not included in his list, but the ostrich is in my list. Some other people call it the idealist. I call it the flyer. You're basically indifferent to money. You bury your head in your sand. You don't want to think about it. Your childhood experience with money may be that your family never spoke about it. So it is not a part of your language.
There are personal finance nerds. Now, I hope we're taking back that nerd because this is probably me. And I don't know if I like the word nerd. What did you make of this?
It's cool to be nerdy. It's cool to be nerdy now, Bruce. Yeah. Yes, I say so.
All right.
But yes, being a personal finance nerd, I think, is synonymous with being a saver, a stockpiler. Those are some of the other names that studies have given these individuals, these wonderful people who I consider myself part of this group. They count every penny. They love spreadsheets. They obsessively save. There could be a downside to this, obviously, being obsessed with counting every penny. But that is something that I identify with for sure.
I feel like this is a type that might be over-glamorized, even though this describes the two of us. And I say that because a lot of people feel like, well, I can't be like that, so therefore I may as well be an ostrich because I'm never doing all those other things. And as I think you and I would agree, we live on a spectrum, and the nerds do not need to, the behavior of the nerds does not need to be ubiquitous in order for people to be successful managing their money.
No, and I think there are different money styles out there, and you may relate to different parts of different money personalities, right? Like you said, it's not a monolith, you know, you can be shades.
Free spirits is another one that Ramit talks about. They look at their credit balance, maybe they move on. What did you take away from the free spirit type? Is there parts of that that work well and parts that don't work so well?
I feel like a free spirit is more of a hedonist, more of a spender, somebody perhaps who splurges to make themselves happy. This is a category of people. They may have higher debt. You know, they want to enjoy life regardless of how much money they have in the bank, right? So you make your life enjoyable regardless of what that means.
His fifth style, he calls them automators, which I don't know. That seems like just a subgroup of the personal finance nerds. It's a behavior that I think works. And I think you could be a free spirit and be an automator. You can be an ostrich and be an automator too. Am I right?
I completely agree. This was the personality that I thought, well, this really could be anything. It's just a tool that people use to make their lives more simple. But then you can also be someone who just automates it and never looks. A couple of other personalities that I feel that are missed in this particular list is the so-called nurturer or security seeker. This is something that I really identify with. And as someone who has a lot of friends who have immigrant family members, this is that subset of people who will save lots of money for their loved ones, who spend a lot of money on others, but they never spend on themselves. You know, that idea that, you know, I will suffer so that other people can prosper.
What of this is just deeply ingrained in who we are as humans, and what can be influenced? Because if we look at like the hardcore personality tests and preferences, the one that I know best is Myers-Briggs. And there's a dichotomy in Myers-Briggs that is extrovert versus introvert. And I am so, so far down the path of extrovert. Like I just don't even know what I would do if I couldn't talk to people. The pandemic just about killed me because I couldn't be out there talking to people all the time. And that is, it feels to me very hardwired into who I am and what I value. What of this lives there, and what can you work on and modify and, you know, smooth the edges on?
I definitely believe that we are hardwired at birth to have certain behaviors. You know, you think about when you were a small child, were you the kid who saved all the Halloween candy like me and categorized it until the next year so that I could eat it in next October 29th before I planned to get more? Or were you like my husband who basically ate it all in a day and then the next day tried to negotiate to take other people's candies? Right. So there is that portion that is baked in you. And I do think there is another huge portion that is learned from your family, learned from your culture, society, what is reflected back to you about money, depending on whether you are female, you're BIPOC. There's that portion, the money scripts. You know, everybody talks about what is the money stories in your life.
with any area in which you want to improve yourself, you want to alter your behavior, a strong dose of introspection and insight can be really, really helpful. Where do these money personality tests, for lack of a better phrase, fit within that introspection? What can you do with them that will be something more than just the dishy and delightful entertainment of a cosmopolitan magazine on the sun, covered out in the sun in the summer, covered with baby oil and eating Doritos?
You just described my dream day.
I know.
I always say that with any money makeover, any financial empowerment, that needs to begin with you looking at you. Check yourself before you wreck your wealth. And some of these fun quizzes can be a conversation starter for you and your partner. It is a great way to get started talking without fighting about the differences in your life. You know, my husband is a combination of a money maker, somebody who sees that money is a status symbol, and he's a hedonist. He's come from a family of entrepreneurs who work so hard to give their family gifts. I understand this. I am from a family of immigrants. We are all about scarcity, cultural responsibility to take care of others, even at your expense. We buy the cheap toilet paper and our butts suffer so we can save money to share it. But this is an opportunity for you to talk about it and then reflect on some of your scripts.
We are both parents, and that is a lot. It's a lot.
A lot of responsibility.
Oh my God, these monsters in our home. We love them. We love them. How do you connect this conversation about money personality or money types to your parenting?
I think about it all the time, Bruce, and I feel guilty about it all the time because my husband and I literally had an argument about this yesterday in the car in front of my children. We were talking about him wanting to splurge on something for our upcoming vacation. And I was saying no, and he was saying yes. And he was telling my son in the backseat that mommy can be cheap. And I said, daddy wants to spend on stuff we may not need. So this was this conversation. But what is a great exercise that we all can do is to be mindful of the way that you talk about money, because we are trying to explain to our son why we have these beliefs. And that is something that you can do. So three simple things you can do: reflect, reframe, rewrite. So reflect. What are some things that, three things that you learned about money from your dad? What is the happiest memory you've ever had with money? What was your most traumatic? And then write down your money beliefs. The second thing is to reframe them. Are they helpful or harmful? If they are harmful, then you need to figure out how to rewrite them. Finally, when you do rewrite them, can you rewrite it in a way that is empowering? Mm.
Can you come to my house? Could I outsource this with my 13-year-old? I'll come over to your house and mow your lawn or make dinner or something if you do that magic work with my child.
That magic work is the hardest work we will ever do. I can barely do it in my own household, but I can try. I'll try.
You can try. Melissa, it is a delight to see you. Thank you for being here.
It's a pleasure.
Melissa Leong joining us to talk about one version of the many, many, many versions of personality types as it relates to money. Stay with us. Coming up next on Moolala, I'm going to speak to Julie Kuzmic from Equifax Canada about how Canadians are fighting back against fraud and identity theft. And later, financial insight on pro athletes, a world I can only imagine, but an interesting one at that. What do you do when you're making $10 million a year and you're 19 years old? Paul Wiley from BMO Family Office Canada will be here.
You're listening to Moolala, Money Made Simple, with Bruce Ellery on Canada Talks, Sirius XM 167.
Welcome back. Moolala, Money Made Simple is brought to you in part by Credit Canada. I am the CEO of the organization, and we are Canada's longest standing nonprofit credit counseling agency. Our mission is to help people get out of debt so they can get back into life. Listen, debt is a brutal reality for millions of Canadians. it starts to pile on for lots and lots of different reasons: job loss, divorce, illness, bad luck, you name it. Our accredited credit counselors are available to help you understand your current financial situation and take you through all your options on how to move forward. And there really are options out there. So go to creditcanada.com. We are nonprofit, as I said. The counseling is free and judgment free. We are all vulnerable to fraud, to identity theft, to all those horrendous stories. I actually have personal experience of having gone through a pretty horrendous experience. I'm going to start that again. We are all vulnerable to identity theft and fraud, and I now have personal experience of what that looks like, what that feels like, and the steps one needs to take to rectify the situation. But there are things you can do to reduce the risk of it happening to you. And a recent survey from Equifax shows that Canadians are actually fighting back and taking more steps than they have ever done in the past. To talk about this survey and to share some of her tips on addressing this pervasive problem is Julie Kuzmic. She is the Senior Compliance Officer, Consumer Advocacy at Equifax Canada. She's in Guelph, Ontario. Hello there.
Hello, Bruce. Good to see you.
Well, I love that we're talking about fraud. Hooray for that. You and I can have fun with anything. What surprised you about the results of the survey that we're going to be talking about? Because there's some stuff that's head noddingly, yeah, of course, that makes sense. What surprised you?
I'm happy to see that more people are paying attention to fraud and recognizing that this is an issue that can affect any one of us. I mean, for heaven's sake, Bruce, if it happened to you, what hope do the rest of us have? Yeah. So that's a really important thing, that we're seeing a decrease in the number of Canadians who are responding to survey questions saying things like, fraud is unlikely to happen to me, or identity theft is unlikely to happen to me. But here's something I find really interesting that is a response we've seen similar to last year, which is the number of people who believe that the government needs to do a better job educating us, the people, about fraud and identity theft. So we see a resounding 86% of people agreeing with that statement in the survey we recently ran. Last year it was 83%, so pretty similar numbers. And I'm really excited to bounce this off you, because few people know about financial literacy and how to educate Canadians about it more than you, or even on par with you. And here's what I'm wondering about this. I'm wondering if there might be a disconnect between what people think they need, which is we need our government to educate us more, and what they actually will respond to. There's a really interesting story that I've heard about McDonald's, actually, fast food. Sometime in the last 10 years or so, they were doing a lot of surveying of populations to see what people wanted to see on the menu. And they found an overwhelming majority of people are asking for salads on the menu. So McDonald's rolled out a number of different salad options. And they found that those same people who were asking for it and saying that they would buy salads from McDonald's were not actually doing that when they found themselves.
Burger and fries. I want a burger and fries.
Right. And I may or may not be able to relate to that, that future me would prefer if I'd eaten a salad, but current me would really like something a little more meaty and cheesy. So I wonder if there might be a similar sort of human nature thing going on here, where people feel like our government really needs to be warning us about this. But do people even really pay attention when governments are warning us about things like that?
Yeah, I think it's a great question. And I think the simple answer is no. And what works on, interventions is maybe some knowledge, but more the behavioral nudges that governments and institutions can enact. We see that in smoking. I think we see that in fraud. It reminds me of the old line that we should be doing more on financial literacy in schools. And people this, you know, universal belief that that's going to be the big difference maker. And there is a lot of financial literacy that happens in schools and even in areas where it is completely ingrained in part of the curriculum, in the curriculum. We realize the shortcomings of knowledge because it more comes down to behavior, right?
Well, one of my favorite lines is that if knowledge led to action, then wouldn't we all be thin and fit?
Yes. Yes, yes, we would. Okay, so just bringing it back to fraud here, one of the things that your survey looked at is the common steps, like the things that we kind of know to do. What's Canadians' understanding of the things that we know to do? Do they know the basics?
We are seeing quite a number of people responding that they take two or more of steps like changing their passwords often, making sure that they're using strong passwords in the first place, carefully disposing of their documents, because of course, often people think about fraud as being a very technical internet-based situation, and people sometimes develop a false sense of confidence that, well, I know not to click on any fraudulent links. Mm. I'm not going to fall for that. I'm not answering those potentially fraudulent calls. But people sometimes forget that fraudsters will take the easiest path. If they find your unshredded Visa bill or your bank account statement sitting in your recycling bin, then that's a gold mine for them to try to use your good credit history in order to apply for new credit in your name.
One of the areas in which I think it's fair to say our understanding is limited is on social media. So we know not to, we know that we can't put something into the recycling bin that has personal information. We have a much lower standard for what we put out on social media. And one of the things your survey looks at is sharing less on social media. What does less mean? Is it less quantity? Is it fewer details? What does that mean?
Well, those are really interesting aspects to dig into. Now, our survey didn't go as far as asking a secondary question around what are you sharing less of? But we did introduce a new question this year with a fascinating response, which was asking people, which social media platforms do you feel have the most potential for fraud and identity theft? And then we named all the social media platforms we could think of. And there were some in here that I haven't even heard of because I guess I'm a bit too old. But luckily we had younger, more hip people putting together this particular question. Facebook was far and away the one that people feel has the most potential for fraud or identity theft. Hmm. The answer for the people choosing that one, it was 6 times greater than people choosing wow. any of the other ones, your Instagram, TikTok, WhatsApp, Twitter, all of those other ones. So isn't that interesting, that perception around Facebook specifically?
Yeah. So there are common steps. There are some additional steps, and sharing less on social media is one. Another one is two-step password authentication. How common is that? Are people doing a better job on that?
Yeah, no, I was pleasantly surprised to see a majority of people saying that they would rather do business with an organization online that is using two-step authentication. So that's where you're receiving the PIN by SMS to your cell phone or to your mobile device or email. Now, we were expecting to hear from people that that is considered extra friction. It takes longer to get into the account that you're trying to log into. We were quite surprised to find that a lot of people actually take comfort in that, and they see that as an organization being responsible and being and using a very robust form of protecting their own personal information.
Julie, I found in my case, the identity theft when I looked at my credit score and ta-da, it had plummeted precipitously. So that was my indication. Do you think enough people are doing that basic due diligence check?
We're happy to see that more people are checking, and I would really focus on the credit report more than the credit score. But what a good first indicator that was clearly in your case. Well, wait a minute, why has the score gone down so much? Which obviously then triggered you to take a look at the information on your credit report. We only saw about half of the respondents saying that that is something that they are doing regularly. And that's something that I absolutely encourage everyone to do. You can see your credit report for free online at both the major Canadian credit bureaus, which are Equifax and TransUnion. And even at Equifax, you can actually see your score for free online as well, no matter where you live in Canada. And for people who want to be able to monitor that, if you create a free account, that'll get updated on a monthly basis. So you can continue to see those updates. If somebody needs a little more peace of mind, or maybe they need to do a little more in-depth monitoring, there are other options that can cost some money. But there are a lot of different opportunities out there for people to keep that eye on their credit reports, which is such an important thing to do.
Just before we go here, I want to make sure that we talk about best practices on passwords. And I bet you're going to tell me that mom's maiden name is not the gold standard.
That's not advised. It's also not your social insurance number. Wouldn't recommend that one either. Unique and strong passwords. And those are the ones that don't have any words in them. It's a combination of letters and numbers and special characters. I got a great tip once about a way of doing that and actually remembering the password. And that is to think of a phrase and use the first letter of each word of the phrase. So I'm going to use Equifax's tagline, which is helping people live their financial best. So that would be HPLTFB, the beginning letter of each one of those words, so that it would be easy for me to remember because I know the phrase, and then I can just key in the first letter of each one of the words. So just a random little tip there for anyone looking for a way of remembering a password.
And a great way to access the Julie Kuzmic online banking portal. So super helpful. You heard it here first.
I'll be posting my social insurance number online shortly.
Very helpful. You know, I mean, I think we could have this conversation every single day, and we might not be having it enough. It's not so much for the government to have, but for people like you and I to have, because we've got the audience and hopefully people are listening to what we say and we'll take some actions in order to reduce the risk of fraud. Julie, thank you so much for joining us today.
Thanks for having me on for this important discussion.
Julie Kuzmic is Senior Compliance Officer, Consumer Advocacy at Equifax Canada.
Hi, it's me, your debt. Look, we need to talk. This isn't working. The missed payments, the collection calls, and all those sleepless nights. We need nonprofit debt counseling, and I found the perfect place. Credit Canada Debt Solutions. They're non-judgmental, 100% confidential. They'll negotiate with creditors and even stop interest. Don't you want to rebuild your credit? You deserve better.
Break up with debt. Visit creditcanada.com.
Coming up later, I'll speak to Paul Wiley from BMO about his tips for athletes to help them navigate their unique financial challenges. They are unique if you're making, I don't know, $10 million a year. But first, all you need to know about corporate executors. Leanne Kaufman is the president and CEO of RBC Royal Trust. She's going to take us through the reasons why someone would consider hiring out for an executor on their will. And to stay up to date on all things Moolala, you can sign up to our newsletter. It's got updates on this show on SiriusXM and stuff that I'm doing on CBC Radio and CityLine. To sign up, just go to moolala.ca.
You're listening to Moolah La, Money Made Simple,
with Bruce Ellery on Canada Talks,
Sirius XM 167.
Coming up with an estate plan is a whole process. There's a bunch of things to do. We have talked on this program time and again about how important it is. But one part of it that can be hard for people is choosing an executor. There are a bunch of duties that will fall to that executor, and sometimes people don't have a ready, willing, and able person in their circle that they can choose, and they may opt for something called a corporate executor. So today we're going to talk about how this option works, what it costs, all those sorts of things. Our guest is Leanne Kaufman. She is the president and CEO of RBC Royal Trust. Hello there.
Hi, Bruce. How are you?
What is a corporate executor?
A corporate executor is an executor like you would consider any other executor to be, except in this case, you've named a corporation. Typically, it's a trust company because trust companies are, by regulation, the only kind of corporation that can hold themselves out to be an executor. But all the same duties, all the same powers and responsibilities, just through a corporation as represented by its employees instead of an individual family member, friend, lawyer, accountant, what have you.
And if it is a corporate executor, I'm not naming an individual. I'm not naming a specific name in my will. I'm naming a firm, and then you would assign an individual to my estate?
That's exactly right. You're naming the firm, and when the time comes to act, the firm will assign the team to you that will administer your estate, just as any other professional service would step in for you in other forms of service in your life.
Tell me a bit more about why people would decide to do this.
So traditionally, I think people have really thought about it mostly in the context of, I don't have someone appropriate to act, whether that's there's literally no family or friends that make sense in the inner circle, or the appropriateness might not make sense, meaning no one that lives nearby, no one that has the prerequisite sort of skills and capabilities to be an executor. But I think increasingly we should be asking ourselves why this isn't an area where we turn to professionals for advice and service just like any other area of our lives.
Yeah, it's a great question. I think about, I've never acted as an executor, but I know people who have, and it is a tremendous amount of work, aside from the emotional burden that it can be. It's just a tremendous amount of work. For someone who does take on this role, for settling an average estate, how long does that take in years, and how much time would it take over the course of those years? Is it 40 hours over 3 years, or is it 300 hours over, could be 5 years?
It's probably closer to the latter, but of course it's going to depend on the nature of the assets, the nature of the relationship with the beneficiaries, et cetera, et cetera. But when we are trying to figure out, how we will staff, we assume that it's at probably 100 hours of our staff's time. But remember, our staff, we do this all day, every day. Yeah. We know what we're doing. And we have the resources and the checklists and the templated letters and all that kind of thing. So assume, 100 hours is, I don't think, an unreasonable assumption, even for an average estate. And then the length of time, you're for sure looking at 2 to 3 years. It's not active for the entire time, but you want to make sure you get tax clearance, for example. Well, that takes months, if not longer. Probate takes months. There's certain things that create periods of inactivity. And so it's unreasonable to expect everything to be wrapped up in 1 year, the way that people might have thought several years ago. You used to hear reference to the executor year. That really isn't reasonable anymore.
And if you think about, we just had some work done at our house. It probably could have been done by a handy person who was willing and interested to watch the YouTube videos to get it done. I have no skills. I am the least skilled person. Light bulbs I can change, and that is about it. So I think for individuals who don't have a predisposition or skills in this area, they're looking to their circle and they don't see someone who rises to the top. I can see this being an opportunity to outsource at a very basic level.
Yeah, and that's the question we cheekily put to the public is, why would you want to do it yourself? Why is this one area where you want to, where you do want to do it yourself? You know, we haven't mentioned the liability yet either. Mm. Massive liability can potentially come with the role of the executor. And if the executor is not also the sole beneficiary or one of the beneficiaries, then you're, you know, you're putting yourself in a difficult position. Where, you know, in any other aspect of your of life, you probably would look to outsource. So it's just it's bizarre to me that it's this sort of last vestige where we hold on to the concept that we have to do it ourselves.
Well, and I think the equation that people need to sort through is cost versus benefit. I think the benefits are really, really clear. What are the costs? How much does it cost?
Yeah, so any executor can charge fees, and they vary from province to province, but generally speaking, you could carry the number of, you know, a maximum of 5% of the value of the estate in your head as what I would say is the outside maximum. At our firm, we don't start at 5%. We start at 3.75%, and we drop from there based on the size of the assets that we're talking about. So it becomes a sliding scale. I mean, typically, I can tell you that across all of the estates that we're currently administering, the average fee is around 2%, maybe a bit above, maybe a bit below. Now, again, that's average, some really big estates and some smaller estates. But again, you know, bear in mind, this isn't just something corporations do. Individuals can and do charge fees as well.
Right. So you are thinking about it in the context of tens of thousands of dollars, depending on what the total estate is. And I assume that's invested assets and real estate and all those things.
Yep. Anything yeah. that if there's, you know, shares of a private company or something like that included, that those would get captured in the value of the estate.
There is a level at which an executor does have some judgment, and I'm using air quotes around some, because a great will has relatively limited room for judgment, because the wishes are clear. But in the case of a trust, for example, I've seen wills where the executor could determine an amount that could be allocated to a kid's education before they come into a potential windfall of a trust at age 35 or something like that. How does a corporate executor make those decisions in the absence of an integration into a family's culture and all that? I mean, I think there's a big pro to that and a con, because they weren't at Thanksgiving in 1987 when that original fight occurred, which is why he can't have the money from the trust.
Well, it's a great question. And I should point out that it's also possible to have co-executors or co-trustees, where it could be a corporate executor along with family members or friends. Okay. So that is an option. And if there's a concern about carrying the family culture, then that is one way to potentially address that. But having said that, corporate executors know the law and the rules very, very well. In the case of Royal Trust, we've been doing this for almost 125 years. So it's, there's some fairly well-established procedures. We have a committee that meets to do discretionary decisions above a certain level. So we get our legal brains involved, our senior managers, and the voice of the client representative all around the table to have a fulsome discussion, consider all the things that need to be considered, and make our decisions accordingly.
One of the benefits, just to come back to those for a second, is in particular circumstances and with certain families, I'm sure that executor could be the target of a whole bunch of angst. How do your professionals deal with that? Or is it as simple as, you know, a family lawyer in a divorce case, this is the job and you just have to roll with it. You're going to be in the midst of some messy business.
Yeah, there's no question that sometimes our clients are beneficiaries who are not happy that we're there. We just know that going in, and we manage the relationship as professionally as we can. And like you said, you know, it's the job. And lots of times there are very grateful people on the other end of the phone, sometimes not so delighted. But, you know, as long as we know that we've done the job to the best of our ability, that we've lived up to our fiduciary obligations, then we stand by that.
Do you
need to have been part of the creation of the will? Or do you take, you know, could you be a corporate executor to any will as written? And I ask because there can be real variability in the quality of the will, and one that you are completely signed off, like, oh my God, this is the best will I've ever read. You could be a corporate executor and it would be easy. Some wills are a mess from the get-go and you were named as the corporate executor, and then you open up that Pandora's box and think, I should have been a tax accountant.
Yeah, so we do prefer to see the wills ahead of time, not only to address some of the things you're talking about around the quality of the drafting, but also just to make sure that we can administer in accordance with the intention of what they're trying to achieve. Because sometimes it gets lost in translation, and we've seen both sides of it. We know what the drafting says in the planning side, but we also know some of the practical pitfalls because we have administered so many accounts. So we may be able to circumvent some of that by, you know, suggesting a tweak to the language and so on, as well as there's a few things we'd like to see in there that we have the power to do as a corporation that, you know, wouldn't naturally be part of a will that, you know, doesn't involve a corporate executor. So we ask for a few clauses to be included in that regard as well.
If you were to have a private chat with a close friend who their family member did not choose a corporate executor, they chose them, and they were about to embark on this path that is anywhere from 1 to 5+ years, what would your quiet, clear advice to them be based on your years of experience in this world?
Well, tongue in cheek, my first reaction would be renounce, get out of it, don't do
yes.
it.
Yes, what were you thinking? Stop.
But, you know, there's still an opportunity for assistance and professional help, even when a corporate executor hasn't been named in the will. So anyone who's named as executor can also seek our assistance and expertise through what we call agent for executor or executor assistance type role. So you can still get professional help.
Okay.
Even without having to have the corporation named. So, you know, we offer that on a more of an a la carte sort of service, but we can do as much or as little of the administration to help a named executor as we would do if we were named directly. The one thing we cannot do is make the decisions on behalf of the executor.
I see. Does that service offering include a therapist?
Well, sometimes I think our trust officers,
that's how they function.
Honorary masters in social work as well.
I'm sure. Really interesting discussion, Leanne. Thank you for joining us.
Thanks for having me. It was fun.
Leanne Kaufman is the president and CEO of RBC Royal Trust, and she joined us to talk about corporate executors. This is a professional service that very, very few Canadians even know about. Now that you know, you can make an informed choice as to whether it's something that you want to add to your estate plan. Coming up, the unique financial challenges that athletes face when it comes to money. You sign that contract at 19, suddenly you're making $10 million a year. Paul Wiley is head of Family Office Canada at BMO Private Wealth. If you have missed an episode of Moolala, you can catch up in two ways. One, you can go to moolala.ca and look at the podcast pull down. You can then search by guest name or by topic, or just listen to the whole episode. You can also go to any of the podcast platforms out there. So Spotify, Stitcher, Amazon, wherever you listen to podcasts, download the full show, write a review, or even subscribe. So the next episode will just be there when you're ready to listen to it.
You're listening to Moolala, Money Made Simple, with Bruce Ellery on Canada Talks, Sirius XM 167.
Spend any time around young people these days, and you know there are a lot of dreamers of young people who hope one day to become professional athletes in any sport that you can mention. It takes a tremendous amount of investment in time and energy to get to that level and succeed, and a tremendous investment in money too. But for athletes who do reach the levels that we see on TV and the lifestyles that many people would aspire to, we should acknowledge that there are certainly financial challenges, financial questions, financial problems that those athletes face. Paul Wiley is head of Family Office Canada, part of BMO Private Wealth, and he's going to join us and talk about some of the dynamics for athletes who work and live at this level. Hello, Paul.
Hello, Bruce. Thank you for having me.
I will never be a professional athlete in any sport, period, full stop, though I do, I'm a recreational athlete. Why we wanted to have you on for this conversation is I think there's really something interesting for us to think about the lives of these athletes and as it relates to their personal finances. When you think about this category of athletes, how would you characterize this group? Who are we talking about?
We're talking about, that 1% of the 1%. They all dream about it. We all dream about it. But these are the few that have made it through in any sport, any discipline, men or women. And they've made it. They've arrived. And it's sensational. We love to follow them. Most of us are fans of one sport or another.
And we hear the occasional story of athletes and other celebrities who face plant financially for, a bunch of reasons. But I want to talk about some of the things that this 1% of the 1% deal with. One is income fluctuation. Tell us how that could work for an athlete. I mean, you have that amazing contract. It's super thrilling, but you may earn a lifetime of income in 5 years and then very little or nothing after that.
Well said. And it's something that we do run into. We're fortunate that we are often brought in, when an athlete is about to make their own money. Their coaches, their families have supported them through the amateur years and setting the stage. They are now signing their first contract. And when that happens, there's a switch that goes on. It's a very rewarding for a lot of that dedication and effort, but they really focused exclusively on the sport, and everything else has been secondary, including what are they going to do when they come into that level of wealth? And the second question that often comes up is, for how long will they have an opportunity to earn that money?
And how, as someone who is an expert on the financial side, how do you frame that? Because if you're working with a regular client, even at the 1%, you can make certain assumptions about the longevity of income. So you're earning whatever you're earning a year, and that's going to continue for 30 years. For an athlete, they're maybe working on that nest egg for a shorter period of time. How do you think about that?
We kind of break it down for families and the athletes to think about it as chapters in their life story. Hmm. They had spent the first chapter or two absolutely dedicated to practice and getting ready. And they're used to being kind of the best of the best in their communities. Now they're making kind of the main stage and they're coming into great wealth, and that there's an opportunity there to do planning, to think it through, think about how long this chapter of earning money will last. And sometimes that's the first, tough conversation that some athletes are having, is a lot of them see some of the superstars on TV that can have 20 years in any given sport. But the average that we're running into is that most professional athletes, for example, using hockey players, have a career span of 5 to 6 years. Mm.
What do you notice about temperament? So if we use hockey again, these are athletes who, they could go into the NHL at 19, 20, 21. Yeah. And so they have this financial windfall that to any 19, 20, 21 year old would be dislocating. Are there some who are, I got to pay the rent and I can't spend money on that black leather couch as much as I want it because I don't know how long this is going to last? And others who are ordering bottle service nightly in the off season?
I do think the majority do not do the bottle service approach. I think depending on the sport and the upbringing that they've, fostered and, come up through, a lot of them do approach this in a very serious approach. Recognizing this chapter in their life they're about to step into for a short period of time, they have an opportunity to make an incredible level of wealth. And also recognize that this will not continue forever. And I think with good support, whether it's family, coaches, or agents, that they are well positioned. We're very fortunate that we can then come into the equation, and most athletes are very comfortable having different coaches. And we come into the equation as being their personal financial coach, and we're able to get into these conversations and really, you know, explore what it is they're looking for and how long they anticipate they could be playing the sport. We want to look at, you know, what ifs on both sides. What if it's shorter than expected? What if it's longer than expected? And then work with their, you know, collective all-star team, appreciating that we've been invited into it, to then help manage that money going forward. Quickly, we, you know, we've often said that agents and families prepare their, you know, the athletes and students for wealth by in this sport, and that we come into the equation to help prepare the money for these athletes for the rest of their lives.
You've used the word family a number of times, and yeah. I think it's relevant because very often those athletes become the breadwinner, not just for themselves, but for their family. So they're not, you know, trust fund babies who are walking into millions because their mom and dad earned it. They are the key earner there. What are some of the tough family dynamics that can present to a young athlete that wouldn't present to someone who's just making their way in the world and the family's not reliant on them to contribute money to buy mom and dad a house or pay the bills?
There was a stat that we've looked at and we've used over the last few years is recognizing, let's use hockey as a backdrop, that the average tenure of professional hockey players is somewhere between 5 to 7 years. So what that means is a lot of these athletes at a young age, 18 or 19, they're signing their first contract, they're making their own money for the first time. But a lot of these players are going to retire before the average Canadian even buys their own first house. Wow. So there's a lot of money, a lot of responsibility early and fast. And when a player or a athlete is not surrounded by a strong family, strong, you know, financial coaches or good agents, then we hear of those stories. Those are the stories that often, you know, catch our attention on the media. We're fortunate that very rarely do we run into those scenarios.
So we've talked mostly about the sort of cash flow framework and keeping lifestyle inflation in check, given the limited duration of that, those earning years. What are the key things that you try and impress upon these young athletes in terms of investing?
When it comes to investing, we will often take a step back and recognize that they've invested in coaches throughout their lives, throughout their different chapters and stages of their growth. They've had different coaches at different times, and that we would suggest that they should continue with that great habit. Is now let's introduce perhaps a financial coach. And that's where the BMO Private Wealth collective team across the country can come in and continue these conversations and go deeper into that wealth equation. And we'd start with that as number one. And number two is that just like a sporting event, regardless of the sport, is that they should have a plan or have a game plan. And that leads us to talking about a financial plan. And it can be very boring for some people, but when it comes to athletes, this is where we can front load a recognition that there's going to be tremendous amount of money earned over, say, the next decade, but then they need that money to work for them for decades to come. And it's really life after sport. Mm.
Coaching is a very powerful connection between the world that they know well and the service that you provide. Health is another powerful connection. Athletes know they need to remain physically and mentally strong and support their health in those realms in order to be good at what they're paid to do. How do you link that back to healthy financial behaviors?
I think it comes back to having coaches, having multiple coaches for different disciplines. On the ice, we use hockey as an analogy, on the ice, athletes are very comfortable having, you know, power play coaches, defensive coaches. When off the ice, all athletes are now, and this is relatively new in the last couple of decades, they're very aware of having, you know, financial coaches, nutritional coaches, lifestyle coaches. When it comes to financial coaching, here's where we can step in and help, you know, work with the other team of experts that an athlete is working with and really set the stage. Let's start with a financial plan, a wealth plan, and really talk about those principles and values that matter to the athlete, and that will often include the families, and look at, you know, a life plan, not just here and now, but let's look over the next 4 or 5 decades and recognize this incredible wealth as an wonderful opportunity, but we can start talking about return on life, return on time, return on effort. Athletes understand, you know, discipline and dedication better than anyone. They sacrifice so much at a young age for, you know, the chance to make it to the show of regardless of their sport. Now we almost turn that around and say, when that's done, how can we, you know, make sure that the money works for you in the best possible way and help them get into life after sport?
For the 99.9% of us who are not professional athletes, we think about insurance in fairly simple ways. We think about life insurance. We think about long-term disability. For an athlete, they're on a contract that has an expectation that they will perform. If they are subject to a career-ending injury, that contract, I don't know how the logistics of it work, but they may not be able to make that money for the duration of the contract because they're simply unable to perform their service. How do you think about the notion of insurance that is outside of what we would traditionally call insurance?
I'm actually delighted that the modern sports age today, and credit to strong agents and strong families and coaches, are starting to have these conversations with athletes, even as we come into the picture, so that the idea around making a lot of financial planning and insurance type, you know, decisions is not new for some athletes. And that, you know, we'll spend the time to kind of go through the what if scenarios, and that a lot of their contracts are structured in a way, and they're also, you know, backed up in a way so that insurance is in place now. Most of us are familiar with, you know, critical illness insurance or life insurance, but there's actually some other types of insurances that can be put in place around, you know, health, so that if something should happen, then the athlete and the families are protected to some degree to help mitigate that change. Because it can be quite drastic for some athletes.
Really interesting stuff. Paul, thank you for joining us today.
Thank you.
Paul Wiley's head of Family Office Canada, part of BMO Private Wealth. And we were talking about this, as Paul said, the 1% of the 1%, those who become professional athletes, they have financial challenges too. They're just like the rest of us. They just skate for a living. That is our show for today. A big thanks to our sponsor, Credit Canada, the longest standing credit counseling, nonprofit credit counseling agency in the country. To reach us, very simple to do, our email address at moolala.ca. We are looking forward to receiving your comments, your questions, your story ideas, your feedback, your sports betting tips. I don't know. And if you want to follow what we do on this show, our newsletter is the best way to do that. You can sign up for that at moolala.ca. On social media, I am at Bruce Selry on Twitter, Bruce Selry Moolala on Facebook. Thank you so much for listening and have a great day.